Blog Talk Radio.
Espionage, hacking, terrorism, economic warfare, political spin, clandestine operations. Unredacted with Rachel Marsden. Lifting the black ink to reveal the covert information and intelligence around global events. And now, here is your host, Rachel Marsden.
Hey, how you doing? Rachel Marsden. Until about 4 or 5 days ago, and then it suddenly got a little bit chilly at night. During the day, it's still sometimes as warm as 20 degrees Celsius, so I don't know what it's like where you are, but it's very bipolar here. So we're surviving that. We're also dealing with the migrant crisis still. It's an ongoing thing because the way Europe works is you debate it ad infinitum and everyone fights about it. Meanwhile, the problem's not being resolved. It's just continuing on. And it's to the point now where there is an article out today suggesting that perhaps Germany is sliding towards civil war because people are fed up with this influx of migrants from everywhere but Europe. And there are small villages that are just not equipped to deal with this. So I'm in the middle of all this right now. Hopefully it's a little bit better where you are. Anyway, on the show today, we're going to talk a bit of cybersecurity and hacking. We're going to go to Virginia, where there is a company, Looking Glass Cyber Solutions, that had actually just released a report related to a very peculiar hack. It's essentially cyber espionage. And what's really interesting to me about this is the interplay between geopolitical events that will be familiar to you and this cyber espionage. And it's the first time, and I've read a lot of these reports that involve hacking and cybersecurity type threats, and this is the first time I've actually seen this level of detail for, on a forensic level, presented very clearly. So the attribution isn't just a crapshoot, because that's often what it is. Remember the Sony hack? Remember that? Happened about a year ago. Remember we were told in the wake of the Sony hack that it was North Korea, and we were just supposed to accept that as fact at face value. The question I asked at the time was, well, I don't accept anything at face value. I'm a skeptic by nature. So you're going to have to give me a little bit more than that. But no, it's just, it's like religion. It was an attack that was executed by North Korea. It was probably related to a Sony movie that they weren't happy about that involved Kim Jong-un. And there you go. That's the explanation. Case closed. And I've always felt very uncomfortable with that. And I'm also really uncomfortable with where that might be taking us, that kind of lack of rigor in examining the outcome of these threats and what we make of them. Because if you think about it, we keep hearing how cybersecurity and hacking is the number one threat to America, to other Western nations, and even greater than terrorism. And yet, it's at the same time, we're just supposed to believe authorities when they tell us that something is. I want to see the evidence. You know, we don't go into wars without asking for evidence, asking for reasoning, making a case. And so now that we're really into, very much into this asymmetric era of warfare where guys at computers can take down grids or potentially steal data that's critical, the most recent example being the Office of Personnel Management in the United States that is now notifying ongoing basis personnel, some of whom actually had clearances, telling them that the Chinese exfiltrated their data from the United States government's possession. And I actually just got word this week from a good friend who served in the military saying that the Green Berets are now getting these kinds of letters from the Office of Personnel Management. And these are top-tier military operatives with top-secret clearances. And then the Chinese have their hands on that data. I mean, that's a scary thought. So, or do they, right? The government says the Chinese have the data. Is that who we're supposed to blame for this? You know, it's, so this is really the first report that looks at that in a very critical forensic way. And I have a lot of questions for these guys. So we're going to be joined by them in the first part of the show. The second part of the show, we're going to have some fun as well, talking about presidential spin doctoring. There's a lot of that going around these days. GOP had their debate again last week. I don't know how many of these we're going to have, but apparently there's no end in sight. I think it was Ben Carson, one of the debates on Facebook instead of television. Some television is supposed to be for special stuff. So there, it's still a year to go before the presidential election, and what, 10 months to go, 9 months to go before each of these parties actually chooses a nominee to represent their party in the general presidential election. So we have a long ways to go with probably a lot more debates. So what is with all this political spin? What are we supposed to make of it? And is there anything we should be aware of or alerted to? We're going to be joined by an expert spin doctor live from Washington, D.C. in the second part of the show to talk about that. So what else is going on? I'm just going to quickly touch on my Tribune column for this week because that's usually a pretty good indication of what's going on in my mind. I was thinking, you know how the oil prices dropped last December? So almost a year ago, they plunged and everybody was thrilled that gas was cheaper at the pump. Although right now I think the feeling is, great, the gas prices are lower, oil prices are lower, but why are they not commensurately lower at the pump? Well, because most of it's government tax anyway. They're not going to let that go. So you're still going to pay the tax. You're just going to pay the tax on a lot cheaper oil. So the tax margin has increased, I guess. So it led me to wonder, how are these petro states doing? And by petro states, let's just leave aside Canada and the United States for the time being. That's a whole other story. And it's very different from what I'm talking about. When I mean petro states, I mean the Gulf. The ones we typically think of when we wonder why there's all this conflict in the Middle East. Those ones. So, you know, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia being the number one. I mean, there's so many of them over there. But let's just, Kuwait, I guess, would be another one. Well, anyway, Russia. Throw Russia into the mix. That's a really important one. So are they panicking over the fact that oil prices have been low for a year? No. And that might surprise you. And you read a lot in the media, and this is where this show gets behind the scenes to the real story of what's going on. You read a lot in the press about how these states should be panicking because they are heavily reliant on revenues from oil and energy. But yet they're not panicking. And I was actually talking to a high-ranking Russian official recently, and he shrugged it off. He said, you know, it's just the way it is. We're adaptable people. We're used to crisis and conflict and turbulence. It's kind of the story of our country, particularly since the fall of the Soviet Union. And he says, we'll ride this out like anything else. It led me to think the way we interpret how these other countries should be reacting to things like this is pretty much 100% seen through our very privileged lens. In the sense that we don't have wars on our soil. When we get warnings from federal authorities about terrorists in our midst, it's usually evokes an image of some warning of, you know, some ISIS terrorists hiding behind a palm tree in a swanky Los Angeles suburb or something like that. And you absolutely must be aware of this threat. It's a totally different world from a lot of these other countries, and they're oil-rich countries. And the other thing that they've done that you might find interesting, particularly because it's not something that we're used to in North America, these countries have socked away their oil money into sovereign wealth investment funds, basically state-managed investment funds. And I'm not talking pocket change, like couch change, that they just shove into these things like piggy banks. The United Arab Emirates has 6 oil revenue funds valued at about $1 trillion. That's a bit of a cushion if anything goes wrong with the oil price, don't you think? Saudi Arabia's oil fund, $672 billion. Kuwait, $592 billion. Qatar, $256 billion. And Russia, 2 sovereign oil funds, and that's just oil, not counting the other investment funds it has, $150 billion. And this high-ranking Russian official was telling me recently that, you know, they've always meant to move ahead with other sectors and to develop sectors other than oil and gas, but these are his exact words he said. But where's the incentive to do that when you can just drill a hole in the ground and money flows out of it? It gushes out of it. So he says, we've been kind of lazy in that regard, and now we realize that, well, you know, we're forced to do things differently, one, because of the sanctions, two, because of the oil price drop that doesn't seem to be going back up anytime soon. So he said, Vladimir Putin had the foresight to do what the former Soviet Union did not, which was take those oil revenues during the boom time, sock them away in sovereign wealth funds managed by the state for a rainy day. And now they're using that money to reinvest in other sectors. Granted, there's a caveat here. I was talking to somebody who, you know, had a vested interest in making the government and the plan look good, but you can't deny the fact that they have, it's a pretty hard fact, they have hundreds of billions sitting in a fund as a result of that oil revenue, and it can be converted. They can coast on that for a while. So it's kind of interesting, particularly because, as I said, it's not something we have. And it's not, can you imagine if we did? We like Wall Street to have those things because, you know, it's, I actually think that one of the reasons why sovereign wealth funds do better in countries where there's more opacity, more opacity, and less transparency is because it's kind of ugly seeing all the pigs belly up to the trough, fall over each other doing it. And that's pretty much, we try to keep that relegated to Wall Street, the shadows of the long buildings on Wall Street. So it would be an ugly scene, I think, and I don't know if we're ready for that. So that's the downside. But it doesn't mean that these other countries aren't doing things differently. And that's something we always have to keep in mind when we try to project that, hey, these guys must be really hurting right now. Could be a much different story. And if you want to go check out the details on that and read the column, you can do so over at our website, unredactedshow.com. And right now, we're going to be joined by our first guests, 2 executives from Looking Glass Cyber Solutions, the leader in threat intelligence and dynamic threat defense with headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. Chris Coleman has served as the president, chief executive officer, and board member of Looking Glass since July 2013. Before joining Looking Glass, Chris was the director of cybersecurity for U.S. public sector at Cisco Systems. And Jason Lewis is an experienced network analyst that has worked in network security since 1996. He's led both private sector and government technology initiatives that have proven to be instrumental in advancing the cyber threat intelligence field. As Chief Collection and Intelligence Officer, he leads the analysis and research efforts at Looking Glass. Prior to joining Looking Glass, he worked to support the intelligence community as a government employee with the Department of Defense. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hello. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
So I have to tell you, I said at the outset of the show in the intro that I've seen your report, this report that we're going to talk about right now, and to me it's just popped. It struck me as so unique because I've seen so much attempt to attribute breaches, hacks, attempts, you know, at cyber espionage, and I've never actually seen forensic evidence laid out as well as it is in this report. So can you give us a bit of background as to what exactly this report is?
Yeah, sure, Rachel. You know, I think that I appreciate your comments because, you know, as you've said, there's a lot of relative hype in the industry, I think, around attribution, and we all like to point our fingers at certain nations. But I think what we put together here really was a report that really showed the overlay of the physical ground campaign with the cyber campaign, which really goes to the fifth dimension of cyber being a component of asymmetrical warfare. So, you know, the findings in the report, you know, while there's the technical detail about it, I think that what we both agree on is the how the report really puts together the chronological events that happened, not just from the Russian movement and the pro-Russian forces on the ground in Ukraine, but that corresponding cyber elements.
Right. So this is essentially, just for the audience's benefit, a report that outlines a Russian state-sponsored cyber espionage campaign active since at least mid-2013. And people listening to this show would recall that that is around the time of that that protest action in Ukraine, around the time of Ukraine's movement away from the Russian sphere towards a deal with Europe, and all the conflict and insurgency that happened in and around that ultimately results in Russia pulling away Crimea as a result of the opportunity presented through that particular conflict. Now, how did this actually start, this cyber campaign? And what was the geopolitical flashpoint that was related to the start of this campaign?
So, the actual dates. So most of what we've documented was the investigation we did, you know, analysis of various pieces of malware that we found. But one of the things that initially triggered us to this was the security service of Ukraine actually issued public statements accusing the Russian FSB of attacking them. Now, you know, it's debatable on what level of attack it actually was, you know, sending malware to someone to try and get access to their machine, you know, if that is not necessarily an act of cyber war, but, you know, there's certainly a level of espionage occurring there.
Yeah, and Rachel, the dates were, you know, this report really documents from, as you said, June of 2013 all the way through April 2015. So, you know, it represents almost a two-year span. And a lot of the things in the report kind of show the targeting really before and after the revolution of the dignity, right, as it was termed, how the targets shifted prior to the revolution. They were very focused on the Ukrainian government alone, but then after the revolution and after the ground campaign began, what we saw is what Jason alluded to, is the malware campaigns that were happening no longer were just targeting the Ukrainian governments, but really started to target law enforcement, and especially the areas in which law enforcement was focused on, and the local police force was focused on trying to thwart the pro-Russian movement.
Right. Now, one thing that comes to mind right away is it would be tempting, I think, for any Ukrainian official in the midst of this conflict to point fingers at the Russians and say, hey, they're doing this to us too, they're hacking us, they're committing cyber espionage. And that'd just be one more, you know, one more pot of fuel to add to the fire. Now, how were you able to ascertain that that was an accurate assessment on their part rather than just a political statement?
So we used a couple of different techniques, and some of them are real basic. You know, someone in theory could fake them. So one of the things that we did determine was that the malware was created on a system that was Russian-based. So they had a Russian-based OS, a Russian-based keyboard. So a lot of the things they were doing, they built, you know, on those devices. Now someone else could go and get those and do it themselves, but there were just a lot of signals that pointed to what they were accusing Russia of was pretty accurate. We didn't find evidence of anything that pointed away from that.
You know, what would prevent somebody who's based in Ukraine and is not Russian from getting that kind of equipment? You know what I mean? That's kind of the first thing that popped into my head. Was there evidence that actually refuted that argument or that possibility?
Well, we didn't find anything.
Go ahead, Jason. I'm sorry.
We didn't find anything that refuted that, and we did a lot of analysis on the actual files themselves. So part of what we were doing was monitoring when those files were uploaded to various scanning websites, and we were able to determine the location where they were uploaded from. And so it focused a lot on where the targets were and where we thought the authors of the malware were. So there wasn't anything that pointed to something that, you know, like a third party somewhere else. They were all focused in a small area, like major cities were targeted, and then some areas in the Crimea. So it was it moved very well with where the actual operations were taking place.
Yeah, one thing that struck well in the report is, and I remember this, is that these attacks also happened to occur during a standard work week. So it wasn't some guy in his apartment late at night on a Saturday or something with his hoodie on doing this, right? It was like a standard work week.
Yeah, there was a pretty good correlation with, you know, how someone in those countries would, you know, go to work and, you know, build the malware and then go and test the malware and then upload the malware. So, yeah, there was a lot of correlation there.
Yeah, I think another interesting correlation was just some of the evidence that we saw how the malware campaigns actually stopped during ceasefire times. So what we saw was the campaigns go dormant during ceasefires, and then if the ceasefire was broken, which happened a couple times during these years, in this time span, the campaigns would basically come back active again.
So there was a respect of ceasefires from the cyber aspect of the campaign.
It appears so.
Very interesting. And that's a question that I've always kind of had lingering in the back of my mind is, if we get down to nation state on nation state cyber war, would they actually abide by the parameters laid out in the Talon report, for example, that tries to, you know, frame cyber war within the traditional parameters of warfare and international law? And that's a very interesting finding in that regard, I think. Like, there is some decorum involved.
Yeah, it is very correlative to the ground activities. We saw also not just the correlation with the ceasefires, but also really the correlation of some of the locations where the cyber attacks would be in support of specific buildups or pro-Russian activity in a certain area. So there was just a lot of correlation that supported the SBU's attribution.
Now,
yeah,
what did
they
actually – sorry, go ahead.
So when the SBU actually made those public responses, the attackers changed their techniques. So they would use a different tool that they would hope would not get detected. So there was actually a modification of behavior after they went public each time. So it's pretty interesting that way too.
That is interesting. What were the exact kinds of attacks and what was the result? I mean, was it exfiltration of data or was it a DDoS type of attack where it's kind of an infrastructure disruption attack? What were they exactly?
They were primarily looking to get access to documents, so exfiltration, and they would try to get remote access to the systems and then from there gain access to other systems or send. So one of the things they were doing was taking documents off a machine, modifying them, implanting them with malware, and then sending them back to hopefully get other people that were interested in those documents to open them, execute them, and then, you know, hope to penetrate further into the network.
Oh, so it's like a remote access Trojan. And how did these the victims become vulnerable? Was it through typical link click spear phishing, human, social engineering? What were exactly the techniques?
Well, I think they have attempted all techniques, so that is one of them. And if they are, once they have access to a system, then they try to send that malware is coming from someone that was like, if it's a coworker, you see a coworker sent you something, you try and open that, without thinking, something. So we've been monitoring this for a while now. It's ongoing. They've changed their techniques a couple of times. But we still see, new documents being created and various other, the changes in the tools we're using. And most recently, which is pretty interesting, we're going to be doing a follow-up, I think, on this, is that they've moved to dropping USB sticks around the areas that they want people to infect their computers.
You mean like they just drop them on the floor or in the parking lot and people go, oh, this looks like something smart to put in my computer, like that?
Yep, and I think it's been working. So
that's awful. That's
so one of the things on the spear phishing aspect, Rachel, is that the interesting thing is that they weren't just randomly sending just willy nilly documents in. They were actually using some of the stolen cache of information to repurpose it to ensure and increase the potential for the recipient to actually open it because it was something that looked very familiar.
Wow, and this is something that hasn't stopped. At this point, like today, it's still an ongoing thing, and it's been going since 2013.
Yes. Well, if you're successful, why would you,
right.
Discontinue that? And I've had discussions with other folks that, for the most part, this is not very advanced. It's a very low level, not a lot of there's work involved, but there's not a lot of specific work. Like you could get a tool set off the internet to do these things, but the feedback has been that's exactly what they would want to do is to avoid, something that's pointed right to them because it was so custom that, it's clear that they've had access or they've inside access and it was very advanced. So part of it is making it look primitive so that they can, continue the operation.
So these are tools that they can deploy, things that they would find on hacker forums, things like that?
Yeah. So one of UltraVNC is a remote access tool, and so that's commonly available. And that's one of those. That was another thing that tipped us off is the config files for those things. We were able to identify things that would, indicate that it was a Russian-based system.
Now, how are you able to execute these kinds of forensic examinations in the absence of hardware in Ukraine, if that's the target country, or do you have access?
Well, we do, but executing malware, they call executing a sandbox. So you have an environment that's set up just to be able to do that and then record all the actions of the malware. And so you can do that where you have different operating systems. You can, trick the system into saying that it's in a different location because usually they just rely on the time zone it's in. So we use all those techniques to kind of see if the behavior changes as you execute the malware, but for the most part, this was real basic. There wasn't a lot of that going on.
Do you think they have better capabilities in that regard, or do you think this is pretty much standard modus operandi for the kind of attack that they're capable of executing? Is it all pretty, moderate to low-level stuff?
I think that it's that while this is low level, I think that it takes someone very advanced to go, I'm going to look like I'm not advanced. So I think that if they needed to, they would, go take it to the next level to kind of, penetrate. But I think that they're successful. They're getting the data they need out of it. So there's no reason to really.
Yeah, I think that from an advanced perspective, Rachel, that, if this is Russia, which, like I said, we found nothing to counter the SBU's attribution. The Russians are very capable at creating much more advanced malware than what they've used in this campaign. But it's also not just potentially perceiving to not be advanced. It's also just simply, it's a level of effort. If they're able to achieve their objective without having to put the cycles in, the question is why do it then? So they were able to be successful in executing their campaign without having to get to a level of sophistication. So I don't think that says that they're not capable of getting that sophistication. There's a lot of things out there that shows that they're highly sophisticated. I just think they probably didn't have to in this case.
So these attacks have essentially been attributed to the 16th and 18th centers of the Russian FSB, which is the Domestic Security Agency, right?
Yes.
And what would be the role of, say, the SBR, so the Foreign Intelligence Agency, Russia's CIA equivalent? Would they have these kinds of capabilities as well? And if so, why would they not be involved in this kind of asymmetric cyber activity, particularly against the foreign target?
So we have no reason to believe that this wasn't a combined intelligence campaign of using the cyber elements from FSB and traditional human aspects on the ground. So, there's no reason for us to believe that it wasn't an integrated campaign. We simply were able to report on the information that we had, which was attributed by the Ukrainians back to the FSB. So I think that, for us to think that, I think it's coming more and more apparent, the integrated combined arms approach, and that cyber is just a new component of that combined arms approach and how it plays into the full intelligence life cycle, not just from a signal perspective, but also a unit perspective.
Now, is there any viable defense against this? And if so, is that being applied at this point? How is it being mitigated?
That's part of the problem. So a lot of countries, and I think why this is so successful, a lot of countries in Europe and, the Middle East, they don't have valid licenses for Windows. And if you don't have the valid license, then you can't upgrade the operating system to patch for all this stuff. And so then they're stuck with maybe using antivirus. And if they don't do the same with antivirus, where they're not keeping up with just the basic signatures, then the same issue, that something easy like this gets through, because there's no protection.
And with the remote access Trojan, it's pretty much impossible to stop that anyway, isn't it?
A lot of these, like the ones in this, that we've found, are easy because there's a signature for them. You go, oh, that's, you don't want that on your computer, and so the file is just not allowed.
Really?
The tool in itself is not bad. You could legitimately use this for remote access, but most people do not. But usually gets categorized as just a piece of malware.
The important thing is they're using a standard tool used for remote access to basically repurpose in a malicious manner. So I think also not only is it, as Jason mentioned, a lack of hygiene on the desktop that allows such an attack like this to happen, but it's also just resources to monitoring network transactions, right? I mean, if anybody was looking at this, they would see the connections coming in and back out of these hosts. So I think it's simply just a resource issue as well. But, we see globally, it's an amazing thing, Rachel, how many outdated Windows XP machines are sitting out there today and spewing, age-old viruses like Conficker and that have been, locked down from being able to be updated from a virus or operating perspective for probably, over a decade now. And these types of hosts are just all over the world. It's almost become a DNA, something like Conficker, of the internet traffic.
Yeah, it's like the cyber virus version of tuberculosis. It's all coming back again, or the plague.
Exactly.
So are there any take-home messages from this study that you would, be interested in highlighting? Because there's just so much here, and again, it's really the first time I've seen it laid out in such a convincing way. And I wish more would be done in this regard, because with the Sony hack, for example, I'm still not convinced that wasn't just an internal breach. And I think a lot of hacks that are ultimately attributed to some third external party, could very well just be an internal breach, but it sounds better to say somebody else hacked us rather than we had a rogue employee. But how feasible is it to see these kinds of reports on a regular basis, and why don't we? Is there a reason?
Yeah, I think that, one, it takes a lot of time to put something like this together. I think it takes a lot of access to be able to have to work with the in-country, or to you know, be able to have in-country resources to be able to put all these pieces together. So I think that, you know, you make a great point. We're often pointing fingers, and there's a lot of bad, what I would call bad attribution out there, right? You know, the Chinese hacked somebody because there wasn't the IP address originated in China, right? That could be any right. You know, anybody in the world that is exfiltrating from China to do some type of nefarious activity. So I think that, you know, like I said, once again, I appreciate that you have seen the correlation and work put together in this report, and we really strive to put together something that wasn't just pointing a finger, but really showed that, you know, cyber is here as an active mechanism of a combined arms approach for warfare. And I think this is probably, while we've all talked about it, I am not familiar with anything else in the public front that has actually documented it to this case.
No, I'm not either.
Or to this level.
Yeah, I'm not either. And I've been on the lookout for it, too, for about a year and a half now. And I was running around Black Hat, not this past summer, but the summer before, asking everybody about attribution. And it wasn't even on the radar at that point, because everybody was still talking about internal breaches a la Edward Snowden. But then with the Sony hack, attribution became front and center. And then everyone was just spitballing, it seems. Like, oh, well, it looks like it came from a North Korean IP address, so it must be North Korea. But, I mean, I was DDoSed. My own website was DDoSed. And we put a PCAP on it to figure out where it was coming from. And the packets were coming from North Korea. And I don't have anybody in North Korea who's angry at me. So I know it wasn't actually anybody in North Korea. But that's how easy these things can be spoofed, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very, you know, Rachel, it reminds me of the days of during the Cold War, when we heard about, you know, these submarine warfare stories where the Russians and the U.S. were playing cat and mouse, and everybody heard about it, but, you know, it was all buried under the deep dark sea, and we only assumed it was happening. And I think that, you know, with all the breaches and things that are coming to light, and the acknowledgement that nation states are doing this type of activity, I just think this report really shows, you know, the takeaway is that cyber is a component of the combined arms campaign and of any mature nation. And it's happening not just in the Ukraine with potentially the FSB, but it's happening in the Middle East with Iran. It's happening, you know, the attribution for Sony when, you know, the NSA stands up and says that it's North Korea. I'd probably take their word for it. But back to your point, there's a lot of bad attribution out there right now. I mean, there's saw something called hatribution the other day, because they attributed something back to China, because in a picture there were two Chinese military hats. So
that's unreal, but I can believe it.
Yeah.
Chris Coleman and Jason Lewis of Looking Glass Cyber Solutions. The website is lgscout.com. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Rachel. You have a great evening.
Thank you. Bye. All right. So we are going to take a very quick break, and I just lost my next guest because I accidentally the switchboard bumps the calls up. So we're going to get him back on the line, and we're just going to take a quick break while we do that, and we'll be right back. After that quick break, I have to apologize to my next guest. I actually got a little too quick on the trigger there with pulling the two calls off the switchboard there, and I accidentally deleted my ex caller. But we're now joined by Eric Desenhall. He is the founder and CEO of Desenhall Resources, a Washington, D.C.-based strategic communications firm and the author of several books on crisis management. His latest book, Glassjaw, A Manifesto for Defending Fragile Reputations in an Age of Instant Scandal, explores how once powerful people, organizations, and brands are easily brought down by seemingly powerless forces through the media and internet, which feed almost exclusively on destructive information. The book highlights new, often counterintuitive strategies for fighting back, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show, Eric. It's great having you back again.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. So first thing that's on my mind is how you've obviously been following the presidential election to date. Being in Washington, D.C., I guess it's kind of unavoidable, right? Now, there's a lot of spin out there, and we have a year to go of this, but with all the debates happening on almost a weekly basis now, I guess, is there anything really striking about this campaign in particular?
Well, the biggest thing that strikes me is everything that we believe to be true has been turned upside down. Normally somebody like Trump with one perceived gaffe would be finished. The more insulting he is, the better he does. And that tells you a little bit about something about how the electorate is feeling. The one thing that has astonished me about this campaign is how poorly other Republicans have a grasp of how to deal with Trump. They're still playing by the old rules whereby, if somebody makes an insulting statement, let's really attack them for that. Well, it's insulting statements that has driven him to the top. I believe that Americans for the last 8 years are so tired of being told that they are intolerant or bigoted or homophobic, that the more Trump plays into that, the better he does. So that's his strength, not his weakness. But I've been amazed. I don't think it would be terribly hard for the other candidates to get under his skin, but they have not chosen to take the route that I thought that they would.
Well, I think maybe they try, but he's just so thick-skinned, I think, that whatever they try to throw at him isn't enough. And I guess they're walking that line maybe between trying to be tough on him while not being perceived as, being jerks, maybe?
Well, I don't know. I think that it's I have no investment in – I don't work for any candidates or anything like that. I think that what's interesting is Trump sues people. Anybody who doubts that he's a billionaire, right, he comes after them. And what I'm stunned by is that other candidates have not hammered over and over again with, you're not a billionaire, you're not a billionaire, you're not a billionaire. A billionaire you are not. You are not self-made. You are not a billionaire.
But he has made billions, right?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. If there are investigative reporters who believe otherwise, and I think that a lot of his business success is really something that I thought that the other candidates could have a lot of fun with, because he gives estimates of $10 or $15 billion. There are investigative reporters out there. Forbes got sued a few years ago because they said he was only worth a few hundred million, and he inherited a few hundred million. But I just think that that the other candidates simply have no sense of how to go at him, because when you do go at him on these points, he becomes unglued. It's to their demerits that they don't know how to handle them. But I think that the other thing that I think has been interesting that is, and I deal with a lot of this in the book that you mentioned, Glassjaw, which is the ridiculous evangelical belief we have in the power of spin when it doesn't have the power people think it does. I was amused to see today that Jeb Bush is hiring, apparently, some consultant who was involved with the media training of Fox News and perhaps other media stars. And what this
training Fox News. I worked at Fox News and I couldn't tell you who that person is.
Well, yeah, no, either could I. But here's my point. It's one thing to train a media person who is already a media person. It's another thing to try to get someone who is not a charismatic character to be charismatic. I mean, one of the things people in my business don't want discussed is the fact that there have been very few image makeovers in history that have ever worked. What there have been is campaigns when you have a strong personality that you could make better, whether that's John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama. These people were not, despite the fact that they are thought of as being very packaged characters, it's really overrated the extent to which they were packaged. They already had a lot of intrinsic appeal, and then the packaging made them better. I think that what's interesting is from the beginning of this republic, we have elected plenty of flawed people. I mean, Richard Nixon was elected twice, despite all of his flaws. And I think the whole idea that Jeb Bush is going to have this makeover and emerge as JFK on the other side is really ridiculous.
Yeah, and also, are we not looking at a campaign that seems to be really appealing as a result of authenticity? Like, do people not sense that whatever Donald Trump is selling, his very blunt, simple, repeated messages, and they're very simple. I mean, it just blows my mind how he just throws out the same thing over and over and over. I'm great. America has problems. We're going to make it great again. That's pretty much his whole thing. He just keeps repeating it. And it's so simple, and yet it's authentic. Like, it just sounds like he's talking, you know, he's saying exactly what he feels, exactly what's on his mind, exactly what's on everyone else's mind out there, in pretty much exactly the kind of words they would use to rant at a buddy in the bar about it.
Well, I think that's right. In fact, I think one of the things that cracks me up is the whole idea that this is attributed to strategy. I don't think Donald Trump has a strategic bone in his body. I think he gets up in the morning and he says two things. One, where's the camera? And number two, what's on my mind that I feel like saying in order to guarantee that the cameras will arrive? I don't think that's the strategy.
Yeah, but I also think he actually believes the things he's saying, because long before he ever decided to run for president back in the 80s, I remember him saying pretty much the same kinds of things, and this stuff didn't just come out of nowhere, right? I mean, he's kind of consistent in his thoughts, beliefs, and also his whole manner of expressing himself and his self-promotional behavior. I mean, that's always been there. And I don't know how much you could actually tweak that even if you wanted to, or, you know.
No, I agree with you. I don't think it's strategic at all. I just think it's who he is. And I think I'll get to what the question mark is in a second, but I think that what a lot of heartland voters are enjoying is that people in Malibu and on the Upper West Side are having a stroke at his success. And I think that now, whether or not that correlates between with being elected president is another thing. But I think after 8 years of having to watch everything that we say for fear that we're going to be accused of being bigots or whatever it is, I think that Trump actively trades on the fact that people are being offended, and that when somebody says, you've offended me, he says, I said it and I meant it. Now, you know, what we don't know is the closer we get to an election, whether or not people will want somebody like that sitting in the Oval Office. I don't claim to know the answer to that, but for now, I think it has been a very good MO. I do think, though, the closer you get to the presidency, the more I think people then begin to rethink things. I mean, if you look at past elections, there have been insurgents in the lead right mm-hmm. now who never got anywhere.
Yeah, it's just that he has a really big lead right now, and I'm not sure if any of the other candidates, unless somebody jumps into the race, somebody unexpected, I don't know how these other guys are going to be able to beat him at this point on the GOP side. Now, on the Democratic side, what is your take on Hillary Clinton and the way she's running her campaign messaging?
Well, you know, I've written a little bit about this, and I think that one of the theories that I have had is that one of the most underrated crisis management skills, and I write about this in my book, is endurance. And people think that, you know, you're supposed to have these entirely charismatic hope and change campaigns. I think her strength is the sheer capacity to endure, and I think that she endured the recent hearings. No, I don't think that she's a particularly great candidate. I think that she has huge weaknesses, but again, we have elected presidents that have huge weaknesses before, and I think that she has shown her capacity to endure, which is, I think that if Bill Clinton had this email scandal, he would have been able to escape it in 2 seconds. She is not Clintonian. She's Nixonian. There's a difference.
What is the difference between the two? And why is Bill so adept at that? Why
charm.
Can't you get out of anything? Oh, it's just charm.
Charm. I mean, I think that, look, the first thing you learn in crisis management is that not all clients are created equal, and that if we like you, you can get away with things that if we don't like you, you can't. When the Lewinsky scandal first broke, it broke on a Monday, and somewhere around that time I went on Geraldo Rivera's show, mm-hmm. and I made a comment that people were stunned by. At this time, people were saying Clinton's going to resign by, you know, the weekend. And I said, not only is he's going to survive this scandal. And Geraldo Rivera said, why are you the only person in this business right now who's saying he's going to survive? And
yeah.
I said, he's going to survive for the same reason beautiful women don't get speeding tickets, because that's how the world works. He's a guy who survives. And look, whether or not this is fair, that's just beside the point. I think that Clinton would have been able to say something that would make people not care too much about the email scandal, whereas with Hillary Clinton, she has this Nixonian quality that with Nixon, you could actually kind of picture him at the Watergate building saying, okay, now you go and put the tape on the door, now go get that flashlight. I mean, he kind of came off that way. With Bill Clinton scandals, there was always the whiff of the screw-up about it, that, you know, even with the sex scandals, I was making out with this person in the back of the car. Oh, sorry, I kind of screwed up. With her, you know, there's always this kind of mastermind feeling about it. But that said, you got to give her credit. She has survived, I think, the toughest part of this. I think when all is said and done, I've always felt that the media are willing to hurt the Clintons, but they won't kill them. And there's a difference.
Yeah, it's almost like a phony war phase. Like, you kind of suspect that the media is favorable to them and likes them, but they have to make it seem as though they're doing their job and due diligence and, you know, putting up at least some kind of opposition to whatever is going on and being dragged through the press at any given time. It's a very interesting dynamic that the Clintons have always had with the press, and I don't know, it's, you know, like you say, they're survivors, and it's one of the big, to me, it's a big mystery, really, but, and it's a very complex thing, I think.
I think that you hit it right, and I think that as we saw in the last debate, the bias was just hemorrhaging, and I have this argument with a lot of my friends. You know, I argued with a friend of mine recently who he had been a journalist for many years with magazine shows, and I commented to him on some of his Facebook posts. I said, do you realize that every time you post this the sort of snarky, smirky, Bill Maher-ish, can you believe these stupid Republicans? Do you understand that some of the people on your Facebook feed are Republicans who are not complete morons? And just this whole subtext that everyone, well, we all know Republicans are brain damaged. Don't we all know? Ha, 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 ha.
Right.
And, the point is I don't think it ever dawns on him as somebody in the media world that you don't see how this correlates with bias in any way. And I think that in fairness, I don't think you can say that the media ignore Clinton scandals. I just don't think that that's true. I just think that they're only willing to go so far.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And the other thing is, if you were to analyze what is wrong with Jeb Bush at this point, other than just saying everything,
I'll be much more analytical than that.
Yeah, I'm sure he would be, but what is going on? I mean, he's at what now in the polls? 7%? He's barely a blip on the radar at this point, and yet he comes from this grand tradition of, you know, two presidents, and he was supposed to be the smart one, right? What happened?
Well, you know, it goes to show you. I mean, you know, it makes me think this is a bit of a strange analogy, but I remember years ago I was out in Los Angeles and I just had lunch by myself, and this guy looked like a Greek god, the handsomest guy I'd ever seen in my life, and he had this look on his face as if to say, I can't believe I'm working at a restaurant serving this guy a Caesar salad, because you could tell what happened to him is he was probably from the middle of nowhere. Somebody said, you're so good looking, you could be a movie star. He goes out to LA and he's a waiter. And I think that, you know, you can see there was all this anticipation with Bush, and it's sort of been a dud so far. And a lot of it's because the currency that the Republican electorate is trading on right now is very much the Republicans want to turn Washington upside down. And it's hard for Jeb. And this is why Trump is resonating, where Jeb is sort of the elder statesman and the model of his father, not even his brother, but his father, sort of this establishment candidate who doesn't want to offend anybody. And when he tries to do something to shake things up, it doesn't come naturally. I mean, not everybody can pull off Trump's routine. I mean, you know, just because I like watching movies about Navy SEALs doesn't mean I am one or could be one. And
now,
and that's the problem he's having.
In your book, Glassjaw, Manifesto for Defending Fragile Reputations in an Age of Instant Scandal, which came out last October, I guess it's probably in, it's still out there. And it's in a new edition with paperback, hardback, or usually a year later they come out in a different version, or is it the same version?
You know, it's still, I think what's interesting is with electronic books, you know, the old rules don't apply with
first
hardback and paperback. So, you know, the book deals with plenty of recent scandals. I mean, the reason why the book is called Glassjaw is a boxing term for not being able to take a hit. And I just saw, you know, you see today, Chipotle, you know, once the company that could do no wrong has shut some restaurants due to a bacteria of some kind. You see this executive of, I believe it was Taco Bell, was fired. He was sitting in the back seat of an Uber car and was drunk and proceeded to start punching the Uber driver, lost his job. My point being, it takes about a nanosecond to completely ruin your life. And that's really what the point is of the book. I think, you know, Trump is an exception to it. But I think in this climate, it really doesn't take much for somebody to be brought down in the manner of Anthony Weiner, although, you know, that was a rather extraordinary self-inflicted wound. But the basic thesis of the book is that any old rule of crisis management has completely gone out the window. In fact, a victory, you know you're doing well in a crisis situation when people cease to be interested in your crisis. That's the win. As opposed to, I had this comeback that was so incredibly powerful that everybody has rallied behind me. That's not how you measure good crisis management in this climate.
And why has it changed? Like, why isn't that a feasible result to expect?
It's a combination of two things, Rachel. One is the internet. I mean, you know, it used to be when I got into this business 30-some years ago, the masses did not have power. You know, a company had power. A TV network had power. A consumer, you know, they could always go on 60 Minutes and have power, but 60 Minutes, they did back then, they would vet things. Now, my average day is spent, you know, a handful of moms get on Facebook and hold a conglomerate hostage. Now, you know, how you feel about that depends on what your political worldview is. I mean, if you I think that people tend to romanticize the idea that any old person in the heartland who has a grievance must be virtuous because they're the single lone individual. If you spent your living the way I did, I don't have the affection for self-styled whistleblowers that a lot of people do because I don't think that they're always honest. So I think that the internet and the power it's granted people has changed things. I think that the other thing that's changed is Hollywood has come to define the spin industry. Nobody, I mean, you know, when I told people what I did for a living 30 years ago, they would be like, what? What? Now, I think people say one of two things. Number one is, oh, yeah, my brother-in-law has a crisis management firm. or they believe what they see, how crisis management is now reflected by Hollywood. I mean, you have TV shows like Scandal, where crisis managers are really pulling Jedi mind tricks. That if you hire the right guy, he could do magic to make it go away. I mean, you now have a movie out there called, which I haven't seen yet, candidly, Our Brand is Crisis, where political consultants are the rock stars. Nobody ever thought of political consultants as rock stars, you know, 20 years ago.
Wag the Dog, right? Wag the Dog.
I'm sorry?
There was that movie, Wag the Dog, which is based on what's in the White House, right?
Yeah, you had Wag the Dog, you had Michael Clayton, you have a spin doctor character in The Good Wife, you have shows like Suits, you know, and the spin doctor is always portrayed as diabolically brilliant and can fool the public. And I don't see a lot of evidence that people in my business are quite that clever. What I do think is if you've got a great product you're selling, there's a lot you can do with it, but the key is to get a good product, to get a good client, not that you're able to, you know, turn chicken poop into chicken soup.
And how do you handle the mass mobs on social media, which, as you know, they build to a certain critical mass, and the next thing you know, that translates to traditional media coverage. That seems to be the path, the course of action these days on these things. How do you stop that course of action before it gets to the point where it crosses into the traditional media threshold and ends up in the Washington Post or something like that?
Well, I think that the first thing is to take on the idea that you do stop it. I think that the analogy I think of, and I use this in Glassjaw, is that when you're in a crisis situation, you are the captain of a very small boat in a very rough sea. You can control the controls of the boat, but you don't control the sea. And I think that one of the things I object to is the PR industry has sort of taken over crisis management. And so what they often tell people is, you have to respond on social media right away. And a lot of times what that does, 9 times out of 10, it is the instinct of a targeted figure or organization to over-respond. And by over-responding, you metastasize a situation when a lot of times what we do is some combination of monitoring to see where the issue is going and responding in accordance with how big it's getting. And a lot of what we're doing these days is erring on the side of under-responding rather than over-responding.
That would be my instinct too, and just let them wear themselves out and let it you know, unless the shareholders revolt or something in a situation like
well,
that.
Well, right? Yeah, I mean, to be specific, if I have a client that has a product recall, it is useful to use social media to say, okay, Toyota owners, if you bought a Toyota Corolla between the years 2011 and 2015 on the East Coast of the United States, and it is a manual transmission, you should do X, Y, and Z. That is conveying very specific, useful information.
Sure.
The problem is when you have getting in debates with people on social media, you lose you don't control the stakeholders. And what I have found more often than not is when a large company attempts to engage their critics, the critics will inevitably say, not that the company reached out to me, but the company is spying on me on social media. So here, you know, you think you're being brilliant, and what you've just done is you've picked a fight that might have been better handled by communicating, you know, in a more discreet manner. But the idea that you have to respond in kind is something that the PR industry loves because they get to bill for it.
Well, I have a friend. It's funny you mentioned that. I have a friend who was on an aircraft that had Wi-Fi during the flight, and his girlfriend engaged in about an hour and a half long back and forth on Twitter. It was kind of joking, kind of fun, but it started with very specific complaints they had while they were on the airplane. And so they tweeted with the airline, and then somehow they ended up tweeting with the competitors, like the competition. And they pulled in, I don't know, United and JetBlue. And so everybody was having a big tweet fest while these two were, you know, trying to air their complaints and thoughts on the flight. And I just thought, what is this?
Well, you know, it's funny you use the airline example. I was on a panel a few years ago, and there was a person from an airline company that was talking about what they viewed as their great handling of a crisis. Apparently somebody got on a plane, there was an altercation, the person tweeted about it, and the company tweeted an apology. And all these PR people are just think, oh, my God, that's so brilliant. You use social media and you apologized. And I'm sitting there on this panel thinking, how much of a jerk do I want to be? Because that is the easiest kind of crisis to get out of. If you look at the cases I've gotten corporations that have helped bring down the entire economy, companies that are accused of polluting so badly it destroyed an entire habitat, organizations accused of industrialized child abuse. When you have these type of crises, the idea that there is a cute answer, a little, you know, you do your apology or you use social media, you are dealing with rough, rough situations that very, very few people handle. But so much of the problem with what crisis management has become is that the PR industry merchandises PR as the solution, whereas if you look at what's happening with Volkswagen right now, the solution is not going to be PR. It's going to be firing bad actors, bringing the cars in and fixing them, figuring out what went wrong, and make sure that your future software doesn't misrepresent emissions. It's really an operational issue on multiple levels, rather than, you know, let's hold a news conference and do an ad campaign.
No, I know. And everything, I mean, it's great to have the PR, but it has to be also accompanied by some concrete action that lends credibility to whatever it is that you're saying, I would guess.
No, I think that that's exactly right. And if you look at who gets out of these crises, I mean, one of the things I always look at when I get a case is this organization, do they have, number one, do they have a good counter-narrative? Do they have a good contrary story? I mean, everybody who comes into my office says, we've got a really good story to tell. Well, no, you don't. You know, no, you don't have a good story
to
tell.
I know. I do as well, and I've had organizations come to me and say, hey, we really want to put out a press release for the media, and here are five ideas. They're really great. Which one do you think is the best? And my answer is almost always none of them. Like, they're great if you want to put out an ad, you can use those. But people have a really hard time understanding the difference between promotion and journalism. And if you're appealing to journalists and media, you know, your message has to resonate on a totally different level. But a lot of companies don't get that, right?
No, they don't. They believe, I mean, this is the problem with marketing people being in charge of crisis management, because in marketing, you might have somebody like one product more than another, but you don't have the Visigoths out there trying to kill your product. I mean, the people who, when I'm working on a case, there are people who want my client dead. Mm-hmm. They want them destroyed, vaporized from the planet, okay? Mm-hmm. And marketing people and PR people, they find that kind of talk very, very disturbing, and they tend to confuse communications problems with conflicts. I mean, it's not like one day the Palestinians and the Israelis are going to get together and say, oh, we had a misunderstanding. You were referring to that West Bank? Now that I know that, maybe we could be at peace. This is not a big communications misunderstanding. This is a very deep, long-lasting hate.
Right. No, that's a really good analogy. Eric Desenhall, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Your book is Glassjaw, A Manifesto for Defending Fragile Reputations in an Age of Instant Scandal. We have the link up on the website at unredactedshow.com. You can also buy it through all the usual channels over at Amazon. And thank you so much for joining us.
Rachel, thanks for your real smart questions. I always like talking to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. So that's it for yet another the 50th episode in the history of Unredacted. Head on over to our website if you want to check out some information and links and books of our guest tonight, unredactedshow.com. And we'll be back again next week. So be sure to use it. Good night.